and I'd ask that you please help me welcome Carol M. from Orange County, California, as our speaker tonight.
Unmasking. My name is Carol, and I am an alcoholic. I love the hospitality here, one for each hand. I love that. You know, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm honored to be here. I'm one of those speakers who truly believe it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, of course, I want to thank my friend Lee Carroll. I'll go anywhere Lee asks me to go because he's one of my heroes in AA, one of the most active, solid members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm privileged to know him. I've known him since his, Jeremiah was a baby, I think, and, you know, and to hear the stories and watch the kids grow up and turn into these beautiful, beautiful adults and to have the life that he lives, you know, that's living in sobriety. It's so one thing to talk about sobriety, but when you're here for any period of time and you see people living in the program and the changes in their life, it's just so incredible to see and to be part of. I have a sobriety date. It's February 16th, 1982. I have a home group. I have two home groups. I have the Monday night Seal Beach speakers meeting in Seal Beach. It's open now. You're all welcome to come on down and see us. You'll be coming down to speak for us real soon. And then I have a Zoom home group. I have a sponsor, June G, and at the beginning of this year, or year and a half ago, whenever it was, beginning of the pandemic, she called and said, you cannot be left unattended. You know, it's the first time in my life I stopped working, and I have too much energy, and I get in trouble, and there's always something to do. And she told me, you start going to this meeting, it's out of Florida, and it meets at 9 o'clock in the morning. And at the time, it was the back porch lunch bunch. It was a small meeting. But you know something? When you go to that, people talk about Zoom, but there's 25 people I look at the squares every day. One day it's the speaker, 2 days it's the speaker, one day it's traditions, one day it's steps, one day it's concepts. And then on weekends we have conversation with the drunk. Leah spoke in there for me. And you know, my sobriety has reached a whole total level. I haven't really missed people because I see my 25 friends every single day that I'm around. If I'm in town, I'm there at that meeting. And now I get the privilege. On the birthday trip, when they first started, I knew if I didn't have a commitment, I wouldn't go. I mean, I might be 39 years older, but I've got to have that carrot in front of me to get me there. And so I told them, I need a commitment. So I became the birthday trip. And it was fabulous, you know. And then as we started to grow and grow and grow, I had to give up my commitment and get 7 people to do it. And so now I'm doing the steps. But the point I'm making is that being in that meeting is the first time in my life where I've stopped. Just stopped. And to focus on a meeting like that where they talk about sobriety and they talk about the singleness of purpose every single day, as I said, has brought my sobriety to a whole different level. And I've been privileged to sponsor a couple of people on Zoom. And I love to talk about Bridget. She wanted to be here tonight, but she's camping. Bridget lived in California. She's called Peter in Massachusetts. And she said, he's a needed sponsor called Carol in California. She's a northern, I'm south. And we took her through the steps, and every day, I saw Bridget. And the first meeting she went to, the first live meeting she went to was the Monday night Seal Beach speakers meeting to take her 1-year chip and be the 7-minute speaker. And you know, to be part to watch this, to watch the people grow, is for somebody like me the most incredible gift I've ever been given. And you know, I'm just, and now we're in live meetings again. You know, I drove 5 hours to get up here, and I'm thinking, we used to do this all the time. We used to do this every weekend, you know. Not quite 5 hours, but really. I mean, I felt like I was going cross-country. But on the same token, as soon as I left Santa Barbara and got on the 154, I realized why you all live up here. It is just absolutely beautiful up here. It is God's country. I think it's one of the best-kept secrets of California, this whole little area in here. I want to welcome the new people. I want to congratulate the people with your chips. You know, the milestones are important. Milestones are very important, from 48 hours to almost 40 years. You know, I guess it works. And I hope, I don't know if it's Kathy or Kathy, at 48 hours, I hope you stay. I hope you find here what we have found here. The reason we gather here is that it's fun. You know, we come into Alcoholics Anonymous and we hug and we kiss and we rub up against and we tell each other how much we love each other and how great life is and look at this promotion and look, I got this, I got that. And we forget sometimes because we're happy, joyous, and free, we forget what brings us into the room. What brings us here is not happy, joyous, and free. But the fact that you have been given the gift to sit in a chair tonight is a gift in itself. Hold on to that gift, because no matter what happens to you, if you continue drinking, it'll get worse. And if you stay sober, it'll get better than you can even imagine. And we go through life together. We go through life. We go through the good times, the bad times, the sad times, the mad times. We go through life. But we always do it together. I told you my sobriety day. I told you I have a sponsor. I told you my home group. So now I'll tell you about me, what I used to be like. And I used to be horrible. As I said, this year has brought my sobriety to a whole new level. And I look back on my life and I think, really? I thought I was okay walking around like that. You know, I'm a Boston Irish Catholic, which enables me membership from birth. I come from a real Irish family, which is men were drunk, women were angry. The whole neighborhood was like that. You know, I had two drug uncles. They were best from World War II. You know, and they go and get drunk. They chew up heroin sometimes. They get drunk and they come home. Sometimes they make it home. Sometimes they take a nap in the neighbor's lawn. You never knew what was going to happen. There was chaos, chaos, chaos constantly. And I'm not complaining. I'm just reporting. And there was a lot of abuse in that family. Once my sponsor took me through the steps, I found out it wasn't abuse. It was discipline. But, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I saw it as abuse. And I'm an Irish triplet. That's when my mom had three kids in 2 years, and I'm the baby. And I did not sit in my own skin from the time I was born. I always looked out, and the world was gray and bleak and dark. And I did not want to be. I wanted out. Not out of life, but out of, I just knew Pawtucketville, Lowell, Massachusetts was a problem. There was a world out there, and I was going to go see it. And I took up my first addiction, which was reading. And I didn't read because I wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer. I read to escape. And I would read these novels, and I would have my plans in motion. First one was to get the hell out of Lowell. The other plans I had were going to grow up, travel the world around, wear beautiful clothes, and have all these handsome men chasing me. And thanks to alcohol, I achieved those goals. Yeah. I was a geek. I was a real geek. I was a skinny, I went to my mom when I was a senior in high school and said, I think I want to be a nurse if I can go to this one place in Boston, this one school in Boston. And she thought it was a grand idea. I had no desire to be a nurse whatsoever. I had a desire to get the hell out of Lowell, and that was the first step, Boston. And when I got to Boston, I was as skinny as a pencil. I had bright red hair that stuck out to here. I had freckles everywhere. I turned as red as that man's shirt when you looked at me wrong, and I spit at you when I talked. You know, I mean, that's a bit for you. I mean, I was a geek. I had great nanas, but no social skills whatsoever. I was raised with three things, and they kept me isolated from most people. Those three things I was raised with is that you never, ever tell anybody anything about what's going on here. Never. You never, ever trust anyone because they will betray you. Never, ever trust anyone. And never let anyone know how you feel. You're always fine. Everything is fine. And those are the things that imprinted in me. Those were the manners, great manners, but no social skills except for those three. So I get to Boston, and I get checked into the school, and I get into my room, and the next thing I know, there's a knock on my door that my classmates going down the Peppermint Lounge down in the combat zone in Boston. Would I like to go? I'll go anywhere I'm invited. So I got all dressed up and down to the Peppermint Lounge in the combat zone. I went. It was the 60s. There was a song out at the time, Scotch and Soda. All my heroin drinks, scotch in my books. So I shimmied up to the bar, and I had a scotch and soda. And it's holy water. It's the same way that normal people drink it because they don't appreciate it like we do. My hair got straight. Those freckles disappeared. I grew bumps where I needed them. I could dance in time to the music at the Peppermint Lounge. All these men were telling me how sexy I was. I drank myself pretty that night and how smart I was. You know, hell, I've been reading for years. I had a lot of material to pass on. I loved it. I drank it every opportunity I could from that moment on. I swear it was the first time in my life I could just breathe. I've been in my own skin. I loved it. My story can be summed up in two lines. Alcohol gave me wings to fly and took away my sky. I drank at every opportunity I could. It set me free. As a blackout drinker, I always thought that was the goal and didn't see anything wrong with it because I blacked out from the very beginning. I was told that once I had a personality change when I started drinking. I was either loving or I wanted to fight you. And it was either, you know, punch you or whatever. I'd mouth off people and give them a punch. And I got into a lot of trouble with that. But I defended my right to drink. When I came to the next day with bruises, I just defended my right to drink. I said I was clumsy. I must have fallen down. Nothing about a fight whatsoever. And I just could keep on drinking at every opportunity I could. You know, I'm one of those nurses that'd be out there all night long drinking. And this is the 60s. I'd get up at dark 100 and put on that white uniform that had so much starch in it. It could walk to work by itself. And I'd stop by the oxygen tent and take a couple of whiffs. You know, and it worked. And I still have a resentment about that. They're doing this in Hollywood as some kind of a health treatment, a beauty treatment. I was doing it in the 60s, and I don't get any credit for it at all. You know? So I kept on going along, and I finally graduated, and I got a job at the New England Deaconess Hospital. And I liked that job, but I was itchy, you know. And I don't do cold. Let me tell you that in the very beginning. I do not like cold. And I'm in Massachusetts. And I took the bus and the train, the subway, and I'm standing ready to go in the hospital, and I have a Florida orange in my hand. And I looked up at the thermometer, and the wind factor was 40 below zero. I took one look at that, and I walked in to give 2 weeks notice. I'm out of here. And I went home, and it was eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Where am I going to go? And it was Miami. I picked Miami. So I ended up going to Miami in February, and it was about $200 in my pocket, saying, look out, world, here I come. You know, people say that alcoholics don't have any willpower. They don't know what we're like. When we have something that we want to get done, it's going to get done. So here I'm down in Miami, and I got a little job right away at a docking box type place. And at the time, they were all Cubans and Haitians, so there wasn't much English being spoken, so therefore not much socializing. And I walked back and forth to work, and I stopped every day at this one particular store for groceries, and I saw these gals put a notice up for a roommate. So I went to look at it, and I thought maybe this would be something I'd be interested in. And I talked to them, and they showed me the house, and it was a big mansion on the Miami River, exquisitely furnished. 3-car garage, Olympic-sized swimming pool, it was gorgeous. And they were all airline stewardesses that were gone all the time, and they basically needed someone that would be there all the time. Well, I moved in, and I made sure that place was perfect. It was perfect. I had a yard man, a pool man, a man for all occasions. Because I'm sliding off bar stools, I didn't know I was a perfectionist, but that place had to be perfect. And they came home and I said, all you do is work. Don't you want to go have some fun? I was so ready. I was so ready. And this is the day of the private key club. And there was a quarter deck club. It was a party there that Friday night. And they said they'd pick me up. Well, I went down to Verdine's and I bought a new hunting outfit. You know, one of those that I cut down to here and split up to there. I was dressed on Wednesday. I had no idea where I was going, but I was ready, you know. And they picked me up and they took me to this part of town I had no business being in. And it was go down the alley and up the stairs and down this hallway and knock 3 times on this door. And here comes another Egyptian right now. And that door opened. It was so smoky you could cut it with a knife. Jazz band playing, the clinking of the glasses, and the smoke cleared, and I looked into these big brown eyes, and I went, wow. I love at first sight. I did then, I do now. If I have to think about it, I want nothing to do with it. I looked at that man, and I said, oh my God, that is the man I'm going to marry. And my friend said, you're engaged. I said, details, that's the man I'm going to marry. So he kind of asked my sense of commitment, my commitment level. And this man was an international yachtsman of the professional variety. He wasn't the rich one. He was a professional. He was considered one of the best professionals in the world. And I chased him until he caught me. Ladies know about that, right? And, you know, I believe in soulmates. I do believe in soulmates, and I truly, truly know that he was mine. We sailed the Atlantic, we sailed the Pacific, we skied in Aspen, we fished in Baja, we traveled the world around, and we were in love. We told each other all our secrets and all our fears and all our dreams and all our aspirations, and it was like we were bonded. But no matter how many times I did an inventory on that marriage because he's in full of trouble with alcohol. He never got the opportunity to come here and tell you his version, but I'm his, and I thought you'd get my version. It says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I really believe is my autobiography, it says in that book that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellow man. And I did not understand that for a long time until, again, with the sponsors, he took me through the steps and made me realize that when I start drinking, I can't see anything inside that's wrong with me. But I can sure see where I'm not living, what you're not doing for me, what I don't have. And I'm a mother's daughter. I have a ton that drips acid that cuts like a razor blade. Yeah, I know how to do that. I can just cut you to ribbon. And, you know, this is how I talk. And I'm here to tell you tonight that people will forgive you for what you say, but they're still cutting and never really forget. And worst of all, it affects my feet. I go places I shouldn't be going to and things I shouldn't be doing. And the fighting begins. And I usually throw the first punch. And he throws a punch, and I throw another punch. It was the whole brouhaha. We had the police, the firemen, you know, the ambulances. We had it all constantly going on in my finger up the entire time. You know whose fault this is? It's your fault. If only you behaved, this wouldn't happen. Always out at him. And I told him if he didn't behave, I'd leave him. And one night I was out with my friends, and I met his replacement. And so I went home, and I filed for divorce, and I moved to Oregon with my his replacement. And I was up in Oregon for about 3 or 4 months, and lo and behold, I'm in the same situation again. You know, the fists are flying, it's just the whole brouhaha again. And I'm thinking, God, this is the same man with a different face. You know, I mean, that's what it is. And one night, I mean, I'm proud. I'm not going to tell you people how I made a mistake. And one night, we had a horrible fight, and he stormed away. And the next thing I know, the police were at my door to tell me he had been killed in a drunken accident. And I'll tell you who's standing here tonight. All I could think about is, oh, what's going to happen to me? I'm not a nice person when I drink. I am self-centered to the max. It's all about me. And I didn't know I was afraid, and I didn't know I was guilty. I didn't know how to add the label for the way I felt all the time. I just felt that way all the time. And I was kind of nervous, and I didn't know what to do. And I had friends down in Laguna Beach. All my friends were college graduates, working in the beach houses as cocktail waitresses, making all this money. And so I went down to Laguna Beach. And all my friends, like I said, were working, but I'm not ready to give up my career. So I got a job at the Mission Hospital, and I'd be out drinking with them all night. And then Dr. Hunt comes, iron that uniform, go to work. Patients are throwing up. I'm throwing up, and they want me to take care of them. I have a career change. And I'm so glad about that because I don't have horror stories to make up for. You wonder what kind of a sense of humor God has? I have a panel in that hospital in detox, third Wednesday of every month. I walk down the hall thinking, I hope there's no one here that remembers me, you know. But I just kept on drinking, and then because it was so bad, I became a cocktail waitress, and I moved up to Newport. And at the time, I was empty. I was hollow. When I came to AA and you said active zip, I knew all about that. Because I was always acting as if. How do you want me to be? You want me to be funny? You want me to be sophisticated? You want me to be cheap? I could do whatever. How do you want me to behave? That's how I would behave. Not true to myself at all. I had no idea who I was. And I kept going on like this, and I was so, so sad. And I didn't want to have another relationship at all. I really didn't. So I found the perfect solution, which was the married bartender over at the Red Onion. Because you know, we all know that married men don't leave their wives, right? Like Daddy left her. I didn't like this man. I just liked having an affair with him. And he was there when I wanted him there and gone when I wanted him gone. And not once did he say to me, what's for dinner? Why isn't the house clean? None of that nonsense whatsoever. But Clancy said you can only be bad for as long as you can be bad and it's time to be good again. And I was feeling kind of tacky about this because he was married to a friend of mine. And, you know, I was getting kind of sloppy. So I broke up with him and I went to Mexico with somebody else for a couple of weeks. And when I came back from Mexico, he had had a moment of clarity and decided he wanted to spend his life with me. He and his wife had already filed for divorce. He moved to Colorado and he's mine, all mine. I told you I didn't even like this guy, but, you know, I don't want to look bad. So I lived with him for another 7 years just so I wouldn't look bad. And, you know, and with him, you know, I just wanted to keep going. We went down to South America, we climbed the pyramids. We just kept on going, just keep on going. And I think it was in South America, it was in Guatemala in 1976 when there's a civil war going on and people are getting killed left and right. I find out at that time that my true love here is really a drug-dealing, drug-addict alcoholic. and he's dealing drugs the whole time. And I just knew we wouldn't make it back alive. I just knew we didn't. So I drank that tequila like 24 hours a day I was drinking that. And we came back and I broke up with them. And I figured, you know, at this time in my life, I knew there was something wrong with the way I was living. I knew there was something wrong. And I didn't know what it was, but it was time for me to stop playing. You have an education. It's time for me to get serious about life. But whatever line there is that they say you cross over, I crossed over it. You know, he moved to Maui, and here I am. I'm an alcoholic, and I don't even know it. I crossed over that line, and I'm drinking unattended in the bars of Newport Beach. And you know what happens to women drinking unattended in the bars of Newport Beach? And I got into a lot of trouble. And, you know, I just kept going. And I was just a mess. The one thing that happened to me, I look back now, it's really a blessing. I was in a bad car accident. In my drinking, when I finally did the steps, even though I wasn't an alcoholic for many, many years, I found out I'd been in 3 major car accidents, should not have walked away from any of them, and hard to kill, I guess, you know, and I just denied, but just kept denying it. And he got wind of my accident, and he said, come to Maui, let's try it one more time. And it took me months to recuperate, and I went to Maui, vowing things would be different. I don't know how they were going to be different. How could I possibly keep my word to him if I can't keep it to myself? He was the opening bartender at Kima's restaurant when it opened, and I got a job working for a man who was a tax consultant. I hadn't filed in years, but I showed up to work, so I got the job. And I'd get out of work at 5 o'clock, and he'd go to work at 5 o'clock. And I'd stop just for one drink, just to watch the sunset, just to hear one song, and I can never predict what I will do when I pick up a drink. And most nights he'd get home before I did. And my behavior, he got wind of it, and he threw me out. You know how embarrassing it is to be thrown out that you're drinking by a drug addict, drug dealing alcoholic? I was enraged. And but at this time too, a man had his eye on me. He kind of owned Maui at the time. He was the president of the president of the Chamber of Commerce and the commander of the Yacht Club, and he owned all this property, and he asked me to go to work for him, and I went to work for him. And I had a little house on Front Street with a swimming pool, and I had a brand new red Mustang convertible, and you know, I have all that. I have all this going on. And I have 3 lives I'm living. I have 3 lives I am living. First life I live is my work life. See, I'm from Boston. I know how to show up to work. I'm at work no matter what. I might be there to fall asleep on my desk or throw up, but God, I'm there, you know, and that's my work life. And then I have my social life, you know, because he's the president of the Chamber of Commerce and the Commerce, the Yacht Club. There's a lot of festivities. And I know how to sit my food to say when it's necessary. I can sit my food to say. But then that's my drinking life. And that's every night afterwards. And I'm drinking in those sleazy little bars in Lahaina. I'm drinking with all the locals. I'm a mouthy broad. I'm insulting. I'm looking for a fight. 300 pounds of Samoa, no big deal, I can take them, you know, and this is what I'm like, you know. And I was drinking with the wrong people, they were the wrong people, they were the right people for me at the time, but I got into a lot of trouble. And when I get into trouble, there's 2 things I do, fight or flight. And so I hopped on a plane and I went back to Massachusetts till the heat was off. And when I got back to Massachusetts, I was on the wagon. Now, I'm defending my right to drink. I know drinking is the solution, it's not the problem. But all these people are complaining about my drinking, so I'll just stop drinking in front of my Irish mom so I won't be a problem to her. But in my heart, I couldn't understand why I felt the way I felt when the people who loved me looked at me and asked me that question constantly. What is wrong with you? Why do you do the things you do? Why do you act the way you do? What's going on with you? I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with me. Nothing's wrong with me. Mind your own business. Leave me alone. I'm not bothering anyone. But I just feel sick inside every time somebody asks me that question. So I'm back in Massachusetts and I'm on the wagon. You know that vehicle with the wheels fall off and you're not paying attention? That wagon. And I'm just miserable. I am so, so sad. And I get the phone call. I get the phone call that the car's been repossessed, fired from the job, evicted from the house. And the man I was dating had already had a new girlfriend that he had moved in. And you know, it's cold, I'm acting as if, I'm an alcoholic, I'm heartbroken, I'm disgusted, I have to drink. And I never want to forget Thanksgiving 1981. My sweet little Irish mom was so happy. She had her 3 alcoholic children all home around the dining room table. You know, and we were, I'll tell you, we were a trio. And my brother Peter, the oldest one, was somewhat of a genius. He had an office downstairs, and he went downstairs to work on his computer. I think he's still down there drinking. My brother Johnny was circling the bench, his big wings from New York, 6'8", just going round and round the table. His sobriety date is December 18th, so he was ending up his drinking. But all I know sitting at the table that day was one thing. I had to drink. There's no question. I had to drink. And so I couldn't say anything to Mom. I told her I didn't. I started that sneaky drinking. First it would be a half pint. Then the pint. Then the quart. Then it's getting too expensive because I'm not working, so I get a half gallon of burgundy. You know, getting a half gallon of burgundy after the third floor of your bedroom every single day, that's tricky. But I got it done, and I'm going to bed earlier and earlier and earlier. 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, I'm already tired now, so I can go to my room and drink. And I'm trying to get rid of the bottles, you know, trying to figure out when I could get rid of them when she's not home. And what, it just dawned on me, this ain't right. There's something wrong with this, you know. So I decided I'd go back to Hawaii. I'd figure it out when I get there. And so on January 4th, my natal birthday, I said goodbye to my mom. Now, this visit was very, very important. Sometimes I don't tell people this. But I always had a fire and ice relationship with my mom. I always felt like she hated me because she sure acted that way. And I never, ever left home except in tears and heartbroken, vowing I would never go back. But that visit I was with her, for some reason, I let her in a little bit, and she let me in a little bit, and she hugged me and kissed me when I left that time. It was the first time I left feeling loved and secure. It was the last time I saw her alive. You know, God is God's grace. God's grace. I really believe sometimes that I never would have gotten sober had that relationship not been made up ahead of time. So I left on January 4th, and I ended up in Hawaii sometime in February. I don't know exactly where I've been to this day, and I don't want to know. I guess I drank my way cross country. And all I know is I drank my way out of everyone's life. And I got to Honolulu, and I had about $20 in my pocket. My luggage had fallen apart, so everything I owned was in 2 shopping bags. And I'm sitting there trying to figure out, what am I going to do? I have no place to lay my head. Long distance is hanging up on me. No one wants anything to do with me. What am I going to do? And I think about it, and then, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'll figure it out. And I remember this woman, Mary, at her, had her last drink at my house. And, you know, she was a patchy drinker. She was really sad. And she ended up homeless, so she ended up staying with me. And I kicked her out. I told all my friends I kicked her out, and she smoked, and I was afraid she'd burn my house down. But you know the truth of the matter. I went home and all my booze was gone. I kicked her ass right out the door. Careless where she landed, you know. And she landed at this place called St. Francis Women's Alcoholic Treatment Center. And I was wondering, I wonder if she's still here. So I went to the telephone booth. You young people in the telephone booth saw these big boxes. You know, there's a telephone in there, you have to put money in. And they have a book, and you look up somebody alphabetically, and there's a number. You dial the number, and if they're home, they answer, and if they're not, just keep ringing. No answering machines, right? But she was home. And I said, hi, I'm here visiting, and, you know, just going through. I'm on my way back to Lahaina. I'm just kind of checking to see how you are. And she was so happy to hear from me. She was delighted to hear from me. She was so happy that I was in town because it was her 1-year anniversary in AA. And they were having a party for her. Would I like to go? Oh, that's stupid. Go to the party and sleep at the airport? Of course I'll go to the party. So I took the bus down to Waikiki, and I met her, and then went to her little event. And all the counselors at St. Francis are hugging. They are all on me, paying all this attention to me. And I'm walking around really proud, thinking they should pay attention to me, because this whole event never would have happened had I not thrown her out. I do deserve the credit. This is who we have here. This is how I think, right? You know, and they said nothing about drinking, but they said if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, and you need a place to stay or change your life, and I'm thinking, what for, you know? And the last words they said is that, we'll have a bet of your money if you change your mind. Well, it was President's Day weekend, and Mary was going away for the weekend, so she gave me the keys to her condo and said, no matter what, you have to be out of here Monday. Nope, no problem. So off she goes. It's Friday. Your money's a long way away, you know. But I'm smart. I'm not going into that treatment center because I'll have that label, alcoholic, follow me for the rest of my life. And I know I'm born to be rich and famous someday, and I can't have that label following me, so I'm not going into that treatment center. And I'm not, drinking's not the problem anyway. I have issues. I need a boyfriend, I need a home, I need a job, maybe a husband, I need other things. I just, drinking is not the problem. I'll stop drinking. And so I didn't want to be an alcoholic. So I remembered I had other friends over there, and I called them. And the next day we sailed the entire day. It was a beautiful Hawaiian day, and we sailed all day long up until sunset. They all drank. I didn't drink. It's not a problem. The next day was Valentine's Day. And in Hawaii, everyone goes to the park. The grandmas, the dogs, the cats, the kids, the food, the music, it's fabulous. And I was there all day long, and I didn't drink. See, I am not an alcoholic. I have issues. That's what I have. But the next day is Sunday. And there's something about a Sunday that opens a hole inside of me from my nose to my toes. I don't go into my childhood park, but I'm a throwaway kid. And I, you know, there was never, ever, no one was ever home. And all my friends on Sunday would go to church, and they'd have to go home and cook their dinner and gather in the parlor and get their week planned. And I'd be roaming the streets like an alley cat, always looking in windows, hoping someday I'll belong somewhere. And I never did. And that hole opened up again. And when that opens up, what does an alcoholic do? Get a drink. There was one rule for that treatment center is you don't drink for 3 days. But I'm not going anyway. And so I went to my favorite watering hole, the yacht club, and I could find an alcoholic man anywhere. There were about 300 people at the yacht club, and I found the merchant marine over in the corner. And this is 39 and a half years ago. It was still pretty hot. He came right on over. And I told him I was thinking about moving to Honolulu, and he thought that was a grand idea. So I had a couple of drinks, and he took me to dinner, then we went to the movies. And he said, I really think you should see what Honolulu is really like. I want to show you the city lights up in Kanawha, up in the mountains. And on the way up to the mountains, he stopped at a store and he bought a half gallon of hearty burgundy, took off the top, threw it away, and handed it to me. And up to Kanawha we went. And I drank that whole half gallon all by myself. And you know, he didn't drink. He was in the corner smoking his joint, having his own trip. And I drank that whole thing all by myself, wondering, how did this happen to me? How did I end up like this? I have no place to lay my head. No one wants anything to do with me. I've tried. I have an education. I'm smart. I've been in the fastest circles in the world. Teddy Turner and the Rockefellers used to come to my house for dinner. And no one will talk to me. How did I end up like this? I was so, so sad. I just had no idea what the hell to do with myself. I had no place to go. And so because I had absolutely no place to go, the next day when he dropped me off, I took the bus up Bloody House Street and I checked myself into St. Francis Women's Alcoholic Treatment Center just for a place to lay my head. And today I can tell you that is the day that God put me in the palm of his hand and he delivered me to you. I did not know I had had my last drink. I did not know I was on my way to get sober. I was arrogant. I was feisty. I was mean. I was awful. And I checked into that treatment center and I looked around at some of the people that were there. You know, there were brown ones and white ones and green and yellow ones and fat ones and skinny ones and rich ones and full ones. And I'm looking at them going, oh God, angel of death just shoot me now. How did I ever end up here? Looking down my nose. And they gave me my room and oh, I was so sick of drinking that half gallon of burgundy. All I wanted to do was just go to sleep. And I'm in my room just ready to go to sleep and that bell goes off. New people, treatment center people, ringy dingy dingy, that damn bell. Oh, we're all going to gather in the lobby. They're going to go to AA. I'm not going. I know all about AA. Bulbous nosed old men chanting, waiting to die. I'm not going there. And my friend Mary happened to come up to the treatment center that day. She said, you have to go or you have to sleep on the street. I was debating it for a while, to tell you the truth. And I said, okay, I'll try. She said, don't worry about it. None of your friends will be there. And the stories are interesting. I said, okay, I'll try it. Well, I'm a bit of a snob, even though I'm homeless. I have one designer outfit left in my bag. And I put it on. It's a green felt hat with a big peacock feather, identical green velour jacket, Calvin Klein jeans, and designer jeans are brand new, and knee boots. And off I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so hot. Man, I thought it was so hot. It was about 99 degrees up. That's how hot it was. But of course, all the green is there, having a kissing and rubbing against, so happy to see me. And I'm just dying. I had a hangover that walked in the room ahead of me. I was so sick. And all my inmates came to the front, and I had to stay by the back door in case I had to make a getaway. And this woman got up to speak, Mary Lake. I can beg her anonymity. She's dead. And she's at the podium telling stories that no decent woman would tell their best friend in private. And she's telling a room full of people all these things. And you told the pastor and Jim and right on, Maria, you're going to keep coming back. I'm at the back door going, that woman has no breeding whatsoever. And the next guy gets up to speak, and it's Big Richard. And he weighs about 400 pounds. And he's huge. And he talks pigeon. He drove a garbage truck for a living. He got fired. Everyone left him. He robbed any cab, and even the dog wouldn't sleep with him. Well, I danced back to the treatment center. I certainly did not have want what they had. That was not, I thought all the difference if there was any similarities there. But I always have to stop here and tell you that before I left Hawaii, those two people became my best friends. I got my nursing license back, and I had a job at Kua Kini Hospital, and Mary's husband, Harry, Mary and Harry started the first treatment center in Honolulu, Hina Mako. And Harry was battling cancer, and she moved into the solarium with her futon and did step work all around his chemotherapy. And Big Richard showed up every night after a meeting with the rest of those Samoan hoodlums just to see Harry and to carry on and to just tell what was going on. And I saw sobriety in action. I saw people living sober. No one was crying, they were all laughing, they were all carrying on, you know, and I look back on that now, what a privilege. How blessed was I to have people like that as an example in my life. But not till the second day. So I'm done with AA, I'm not going back there. Good God Almighty, no, no, no. And not today when the bell goes off, Mary comes up and says, we get to go in the band tonight. Well, who cares? We get to buy candy and cigarettes. Yay, we get to go in the band. Okay, so I got in the band. And I bought my cigarettes, I was going to sneak this one out. But this time they pulled into White Like a Hollow, which is the Gucci meeting, and on the way in there were two Rolls Royces and a Mercedes. You know what I'm talking about, right? And I looked upstairs, and there were all these handsome men with Aloha shirts and long pants, smoking their cigarettes, and I thought, well, I'll try one more. Maybe I'm a little bit hasty. So up the stairs I go, and get my peacock feather all adjusted, and up the stairs I go, and this time at the podium, blonde hair, blue eyes, handsome as man, I've seen him a long time. I knew instantly I've been sent to AA to marry him. That's exactly why I'm here. I'm going to marry that man. I just looked at him and I just, that's it. And I never had trouble getting a man in my life, but something strange is going on with me. The only thing that comes out of my mouth is, ah, you know, that's not very sexy. My heart sounds like a bass drum, I know you can hear it in the front row, and this water is pouring out of my hands. But I have a mission. I want to get this man. So he was, again, God knows exactly what I need. This man was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous who didn't care anything about what I wanted. He cared more about my sobriety. And he went to meetings 7 nights a week. So I went to meetings 7 nights a week. Steps to Freedom was his home group. Steps to Freedom became my home group. Wherever he went, I went. 2 meetings on Saturday, 2 on Sunday. I'm living proof. If you bring the body, the brain just might follow. And I would sit there. And I look back on my life, like I said, very much respect, I look and I go, why did I stay? Why did I stay? Because when I sat in these rooms, last one in, first one out, you have to be quiet, and you have to listen, and whether you want to or not, you hear. And people were up there calling the truth. They're telling their truth. And I sit back there, and I think, yeah, I felt like that. How do you know that happened to you? And I started to defrost without even knowing it. Didn't even know it. And people were so kind. They were so kind. I mean, they should have thrown me out. I tried my best to get thrown out, but they just wouldn't do it. They'd offer me a ride. They'd take me for coffee. They'd ask me to go to lunch. And I mean, they were so kind. And I'm on this mission to get this guy. And, you know, I'm 6 months into this, working my tail off, thinking, working as a maid at the time, crying. I was born to have one, not be one. You know, I was just miserable. And finally, this one night, I said, screw this. Screw it. Without the fish in the sea, I'm not coming back anymore. That night he walks by me and he pats me on the head and says, keep coming back, you're a winner. So I have to come on, right? I know he feels the same way. So on 6 months, dry as toast, I got a sponsor because I wanted to look good in front of him. I got Nishiko, who graduated the month before I did from the treatment center, who was Japanese and didn't speak a word of English. So I told her whatever I wanted to and never had to worry about her passing it on. And so I finally get a date with this guy, finally. And then he's coming to pick me up. You know, I'm planning our whole life. He needed a makeover. He needed a new job. We had to move over here. I had the name of about 3 kids that we were going to have. It was all in my head. And the phone rang. And it was my brother telling me my mom died that day of a heart attack. And I was devastated. I finally had an ended relationship with my mom, and she died. And when he came, I thought he would comfort me. But he didn't comfort me. He put me in his car and he took me to the little meeting on the North Shore. And the only thing I had said in A prior to that was a couple of obscenities. Profanity was my native tongue, and I passed, you know. And he told those people one more time what had happened, and they took up a collection and got me the fare to go back to my mom's funeral. And you think I would have gotten the message, but I didn't. I've been using people all my life with another group. I keep telling you, I'm not a nice person when I drink. I do not like being when I drink now. And next day I went to the airport, he dropped me off, and I said, you know, my mom's very prominent. It's going to be a big Irish wake. I'm going to have to drink. And he looked at me and said, you don't think you're an asshole, but what the hell's wrong with you? And he made me mad. It says in the Drop the Rock, it's all about how God uses our defects of character to turn us around. And anger was my favorite one, because, man, that gets me moving. Get me angry, I'll show you. And I went back, and I conducted myself like a lady, and I came back to Honolulu thinking he'd be there with an engagement ring. And instead, he had a schedule in the big book. And he said, I want you to kill yourself. I don't want to watch it anymore. Get a program, get a sponsor, get a life. And I was so, so devastated. And I went home, and I cried and cried and cried. And then when the tears dried up, the anger set in again, and I'll show you. I'll get even with you. And so Steps to Freedom was his home group, so I went to Steps to Freedom every Tuesday. The Hunt and Clothes came back out, and I sit there right in the front row, glaring at him so he could see what he was missing. You know, I don't think he noticed what he was missing. And while I was glaring at him, they had elections. You know, these AA elections they have? And the next, you know, someone's telling me I'm the leadership person. I don't want to be the damn leadership person. I don't want anything to do with any of you. And in those days, you had to take it home with you. And they had to be this rack. And it was disgusting. It was sticky and gooey. The material all had coffee stains and jelly stains all over. I was embarrassed for you. I really was. But I was gone on it. Now I have my vehicle for revenge. So I took it home, threw all the literature out, took it home, sanded it, painted it, went down to central office and bought every bit of literature they had. I had it alphabetized and color-coded. And it was an hour meeting, but I'll tell you, the literature announcements took at least 10 to 15 minutes. I was up there, like, ran away with my literature. I'd read something, you know, and while I was so busy with this little commitment I had, you know, people would, Lee would come up and spill coffee on it, and you'd come up and get a jelly donut on it. God, I'd have to throw it out and go back. It had to be perfect. Little did I know, that commitment was the first real brick in my wheelchair recovery. I got to belong. People knew my name. They would ask me how I was. And I got to be not so nasty, and all of a sudden, things got better. You know, and I kept going to meetings because I had no place else to go. I had no place else to go. I was going to meetings. And one night I'm at this meeting, and this beautiful woman turns around and looks at me and asks me the question. You know, the perfect woman up there with the perfect hair, the perfect makeup, and her designer clothes, with all the little sponges all around her. You know, they're so glad to be sober, all the pink and white, you know, happy to be sober, you know. Multiplying like rabbits every week, they're all over the place. And this woman turns around and looks at me and says to me, what the hell is your problem? You keep showing up here and you're goofier by the day. What is your problem? Well, I was on my last nerve by now, so I was going to let her have it. I really was going to let her have it. And but those are my witnesses. And she's blah, 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 and I'm fueling up. Blah, 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 blah. Just stop your bat and I'll tell you exactly what I think of you. And the last thing I hear out of her mouth is, you need me a cocoa tomorrow night. And she stops, and I'm ready. And these words fly out of my mouth. Yes, ma'am, I have no idea where they came from. No idea at all. And I met Blanche the next night, and she told me, she said, I've been watching you, and your program doesn't seem to be going so well for you. Why don't you try mine for a while? And so she took me through the first 164 pages and told me I'd been here long enough that I had to go home and do my steps. And she said, you can start writing your fourth step now. And I looked at her and said, no, I'm not doing it. She said, you have to write your fourth step. Remember, never ever tell anybody anything. She wants me to write it down on paper and read it to her. I'm not doing it. And every time I had an issue, which I had a lot of them, and I'd call her, she'd hang up on me. The only thing she'd say, you're writing, click. And I got curious. So I lived alone. So I sat in my fourth step under the covers that night with a flashlight, and I started writing. And I wrote up my, I said, where do I begin? She said, how about where you were born? And I started writing. I wrote down everything. when I put an A down next to things that were not so good. And C, I looked at that. I put it on paper, and I looked at it, and I saw where I had been and what I had done and what had been done to me. I looked at it, and I just, no way I'm telling anybody. I'm not reading this to anybody. I was appalled at what I wrote. Moved 22 times, 5 states, 2 countries, burnt a house down at Christmas, you know, blamed it on cheap Christmas decorations, broke up marriage, you know, broke the heart of everybody who loved me, 3 major car accidents, like I said. I looked at my message and my past, it was right there, I put it on this paper. And she kept saying, we're going to do your 5th step. We're not doing my 5th step. Well, she started the ASI, and she came up to my house, and she had a big bouquet of flowers, the torch ginger and the plumeria and the carnations and the orchids. And out of nowhere, she's got a little white candle, lit it and said, let's get on knees and say the 3rd step prayer. Let's ask God to come in the room and help you be honest. And I got on my knees and I said the 3rd step prayer to a God I did not believe in. I did not believe in this God. And something happened. I got up. And I didn't even need my book anymore. I just told her all my secrets and all my guilt and all my shames and all my resentments. It just poured out of me like water. And I never, ever, ever want to forget the beauty of one alcoholic helping another alcoholic. That beautiful face looking back at me. And it just poured out of me. And she, that smile she had, and she shared some things with me and said, perhaps there's some things I've done, said, sit here with God for a couple of hours and see what happens. Meet me tonight. And I met her that night, and sure enough, there were some things left unsaid, and I told her. And that night, however I felt, my entire life vanished. I walked freedom from bondage that night. I was free of the past. It was gone. I don't know what the future held, but all of a sudden, I was okay. All of a sudden, I could fit my own skin. All of a sudden, maybe, maybe, just maybe, I'm enough. And then I made plans to move back to the mainland, and she said, you can't go back unless you do all your steps. I said, okay, so far so good. So she talked me through the 6 steps, you know, with the defects of character, and basically she said, yeah, I could break it down real simple for you. The 6 steps is your defects of character. Stop doing those things you shouldn't be doing. Stop going out with other people's husbands. You know, stop stealing money from work. Stop doing those things. Stop, stop, stop. And then she took me through the shortcomings. And start doing the things you should be doing. Put money in the basket. Show up on time. Return a phone call. Write that thank you note. Start doing this. It was amazing. You know, and if you really want to know how the steps work for me today, is I try and do my 7th step every day. Because then I don't have to do my 6th step. If I don't have to do my 6th step with the defects, then I have to go back to my sponsor. I have to go backwards. You know, so it's been working real fine. And then it was time for the list. I'm going to make an end. It's ridiculous. So I went home and I was very diligent. I wrote that list. I had everybody on that list. And I brought it to her and she took one look at it and 30 seconds later said, there's somebody missing. I said, who's missing? I borrow. She goes, your ex-husband's not on here. I looked at her and said, you fall off a truck and hurt your head. Didn't you hear what he did to me? And she looked at me very lovingly and said, if I lived with you then, I probably would have slapped you around too. Put him on the list. I couldn't. I had drunk at him for 8 years. I hated him. Every fiber of my being, no, I could not do it. And Lance would take me out to lunch. He said, okay, I understand that. But let me ask you a few questions. What kind of a wife were you? What kind of a girlfriend were you? How many times did you see them? How much money did you steal from them? What kind of a home did you give them? Bring in that mirror right up there, right? And I still couldn't do it. So she said, you have to do it. So she sat down and helped me write out an end. She wrote it out. We wrote it out. And she said, call him. And so I picked up the phone. I'm in Honolulu. He's in Miami. And I called him and I read this event to him. And I stopped him when I was through. And I swear to God, when you really make amends to people, his voice changed. All of a sudden I could hear this, it's not all me, you know. And something happened. What happened is a little ray of sunshine came in, and little by little, slowly by slowly, we became the best friends. He always wanted to go back together again, but he still drank, and nothing changes if nothing changes. He lived on the East Coast, but I lived in California. And 32 years later, when he died, I was clean. Everything had been said. Everything was done. That never would have happened had that sponsor not dragged me through those steps. She did that. You know, and there's another one. I told you when I was out there, first beginning my training career, I was engaged when I went into that nightclub and saw my future cousin. And how I broke that engagement was I just sent the ring back. Sent it back. Wedding's off. We had a big wedding planned. Invitations, everything else. Wedding's off. Here, here's your ring. I'll talk to you later. Never heard from him again. And then when I went home that time, his father heard I was in town. And Billy flew from the outskirts of Alaska in a little plane to Nome, to New York, to come and see me. And he wanted to know what had happened, whatever, and I went out with him and I gave him some ha ha ha, and we made plans to do something, and I just let him left the next day without even a goodbye. And he was on my amends list, and my sponsors, all of them said to me, leave him alone. Leave him alone. Do not go there. And about 10 years ago, I was sitting in my living room, the phone rang, and I got this call. He said, I got your number from your brother. I always wanted to know what happened. And I was able to tell him, it's not you, it's me. You caught me at the beginning of my drinking and at the end of my drinking. And that one more time, we're clean. And God's sense of humor, I sponsor his daughter now. That's God's sense of humor. So I moved over here, and I was 3.5 years sober. I was appointed to Mary Regan. She was a big circuit speaker. I drove her everywhere. She taught me to laugh. She introduced me to all the giants in AA, the Keith Carpenters, the Clancy's, you know, to the Pacific Group. And I thought I was really all that, you know, and right there in the front row with my friend Mary and just all that. Then she got a new sponsor, you know, was replaced, and I was ticked, you know. But, you know, I was taught to apply these principles in all my affairs. And I never thought I was going to be self-supporting, but I got a job. And she told me, they're not paying you to talk on the phone to your friends or call me. That they had to get a day's work out of for a day's pay. Start paying attention. And I started paying attention. And, you know, that thing that all alcoholics have, all or nothing, I turned it into quality things. Those defects, I turned into something else. And I got every award you could possibly get. And then 10 years sober, I met AA campus, I met him. The first psychotic relationship I really ever had. And it was bad. I liked being an AA couple. I thought it was nice being an AA couple. You could go to, you had someone to take your spices, drive you when you speak, all these things. I liked being an AA couple. I wasn't really in love with them, but I liked being an AA couple. And this short little blonde down in Newport Beach snatched him away. And everybody knew about it except me until it was done. And I was outraged. Outraged. I am done with AA. Totally, you've all betrayed me. Of course, everyone in AA betrayed me. Not him. And Lynn Wilder wrapped me up and sent me to Clancy. And I became one of those subjects on the 405 every Wednesday, going up to the Pacific Group. And I would tell, I wanted to tell Clancy all my heartaches and all my problems. And all they'd say is, shut up. Do what I do, you'll get what you, if you do what I do, you'll get what I've gotten. And if you do what I do, your problems will disappear through neglect. Just keep going forward. You know what? He's absolutely right. If I don't pay attention to my problems, they have ways of disappearing or resolving themselves one way or the other. And he taught me that structure and discipline which keeps me to this day. And now I have the beautiful June in my life. And June, I just love her. I think you might have her up here to speak. She lives in Oxnard now. And she's the most gracious, giving, kind woman in the world, and I just kind of measure myself over her. And she sponsors a lot of people, and I sponsor a lot of people. Somewhere along the line, these gals came up to me and asked me to sponsor them. I look at them and go, how sick are you? You know, you want me? And yeah, they do. And one by one, they come in. You know, they come in with their broken hearts and their broken dreams and their broken lives. And I'm not smart enough to tell them anything different. I just tell them, get a home group, call me every day, get a commitment. Let's get through this, let's through the steps, let's read the book. Let's just keep doing this. And you see them change right before your eyes. And you see the light come on in their eyes, and the light begins to change. And you also see they go through the heartaches. I mean, I can tell you over here, I've sponsored a lot of people who don't like the way I do it, and they leave. And I've been to the funerals. And I've been to the hospitals, and I've been to the jails, and I wiped the blood off the floor of somebody who committed suicide. Couldn't get it, just could not get this. You know, the first step says, until we admit to our innermost self, the result is nil. I know alcoholics of my kind had a lot of barriers between inner self It took a lot of work to get there, one layer at a time, one layer at a time. But I focus on these over here that do make it. And I watch them. I watch their lives change. You know, we have young ones and old ones, just like the treatment center, that one's a brown one's a green one. We don't care. You know, they're all the same, you know. And you watch them get an education. And I go back to school. Some start off with not even a high school diploma. I have one who didn't have a high school diploma. Now she's a physician's assistant. We have a couple of lawyers. We have all these things that just keep going. But they keep AA first. AA is number one. Their life is around it. The AA is not around their life. It's around it. And they start dating. And that's interesting. That's really interesting, the stories when they start dating. Make your hair curl. And then they get engaged. And we go to engagement parties, we go to graduations, we go to birthday parties, and then we go to the weddings. And the weddings are all special and incredible. They're wonderful. And then they get pregnant. Anybody who's a childbearing age that I sponsor that gets pregnant, there's an absolute solid rule. They can't have that baby unless I'm in the delivery room. And so far they've all obeyed. They've all obeyed. Cross your legs, I'm on my way. And I do this simply because there is nothing in the world to me. You know, God, you see God in so many different ways. I see him in the morning when I look out at the sun. I see him at the beach. I see him so many places. But I think his absolute perfect project he ever did with a human being. And you see that baby come into the world. And I am blessed enough to always be the second one to hold it. And I check it out, the nose, the toes, the ears, the fingers. I check it all out and I look at absolute perfection. Absolute perfection. And I look at it and it's just, I always have the same thought. That's how I came into the world. That's how you came into the world. That's how we all came into the world. And everything negative we've learned. Regardless of what the circumstances are, we learn to be liars and cheaters and thieves and drug addicts and alcoholics. We learn this behavior. And with strong sponsorship and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, we can unlearn those behaviors and get to the middle of the road, which is where we are happy, joyous, and free. And it's just absolutely phenomenal how this whole deal works. This last year has been very interesting to me, very interesting. Along the way, because I apply these principles in all my affairs, I was a nurse for 30 years, and one of my patients recruited me, and I became an executive recruiter. I never realized I could make so much money, and I saved most of it, and I own my own home. I drive the car of my choice, and I manage to put the money in the bank, and I've got awards up the yin-yang. I have one company who made up awards to give them to me, simply because I showed up for work and did it, you know, and that's simple. So as far as all that outside materialistic stuff, I really do have that. I really do have that. But, you know, and all the inventories I've done, I'm not really marriage material. I live in an alcoholic house because sometimes it can be kind of testy and I live alone, you know, and I know this. I know I'm not material. And about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, I spoke to this guy who's in the program, and he started texting me every night. Every night he's texting me. You want to go out? No. No. And finally, when I was with him, he said, hey, I'm too old for you. You know, can you see this? He goes, I know exactly how old you are. Do you want to go to the movies? And I did want to see The Joker. And so, we went to see The Joker. And that's been 2.5 years. And he's the most solid person I've ever known. He lets me be exactly who I am. He knows that AA comes first no matter what. And hopefully it does in his life too. And last year in the pandemic, we traveled all across the United States. We have an RV and with a garage bed calling for some motorcycles in the back. I'm lipstick and lace. He's a biker. I'm not biker material, but I am now. And, you know, he thinks to bike, and we go to Glacier Park, and we camp out someplace, and he'll go fishing, and we have that fresh fish for dinner, and, you know, he's the nicest guy I know. He really is, and I keep thinking, how does this happen? I'm telling you this because so many women come to me, oh, I want to meet a man, you know. I was 76 when I met him. There's hope, you know. But, you know, I think to myself, the life I have lived, like I said this last year, through the 11th step, through self-examination, prayer, and meditation, it will give you a strong threshold on life, a strong one on life, not just on the program. And as a result of doing the self-meditation, because I've had the time, and the being of service, you want to know how I stayed sober? It was all service, always a commitment. I always had a commitment. Most of them I never wanted. I was appointed to them, but I did them. I might have done them angrily, hostile, Doesn't make any difference. Doesn't make any difference what we think, what we know, what we feel, it's what we do. And those commitments have always been the carrot to get me to a meeting. And there are many nights when I just start going, oh my God, do I have to go again, take a shower, get up there. That's how I feel going up. But I always feel 1,000 times better going home. Because I see the magic, and I see the smiles, and I see the recovery, and I see the miracles that happen in this program. I see the people living life of joy, you know, and that's where I am now. I live a life of joy. The three most important gifts alcoholics has given me is a quiet mind. My mind is quiet. I have peace in my soul. I'm totally at peace. I'm just enough. I love where I live. I love my life. Not only do I love it, I like it, you know, and I have love in my heart. I love so many people, and I know I can receive love today. And those are the three greatest gifts that Alcoholics Anonymous can ever give you. That's exactly what we're here for. One alcoholic talking to another. The magic of this program. Thank you for letting me share.